The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian sitting areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when their travels bring them to Washington. For more information, visit www.tabardinn.com.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues, the show where you call in or email in all of your cooking-related questions, technical or not. I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues, here with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. Cooking Issues, big old hammer, bringing the hammer down on all you people that don't behave. Although we've never had anyone not behave, actually. We've never actually had to use your hammer. I think you're just so frightening.
Right.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, so call in all your questions live to the studio at 718-497-2128, 718-497-2128, here for the next 45 minutes or so, please call in your questions. What's going on here, Nastasha? I'm flying out to Florida today, right?
Yeah.
So
did you look over the stuff?
No, of course not, but they don't need to know that. by the way, it is true, I'll give you a partial announcement now, but in the near future, you know, we might be open to consulting kinds of situations. But just so you know, should you ever hire me, Nastasha, which is a Cooking Issues team at this point, should you ever hire us for anything, we're not going to think about your problem until it's actually time to think about your problem.
That's true. Well, we'll try to break him of that if
right.
We can.
Sure. So speaking of thinking about problem, last week we came on the show and we asked for any sort of suggestions as to what to do with our 3D printer, because we have this 3D printer that was given to us by the Fab at Home guys at Cornell. It prints, basically, it's a syringe that moves around in three dimensions and squeezes out, you know, at a very precise rate, any sort of paste. Any paste that you want. And they wanted us to come up with a good food application, and we didn't for about 8 months. We didn't come up with one. And, finally, a couple people have called to interview me, actually, about what I thought about 3D food printing, and I always said pretty much the same thing, which is no one's thought of a really good application yet, and, you know, I think it's a, you know, there's no need to print, you know, the Mickey Mouse in the, you know, out of turkey paste. I mean, there's just no need for it, because I can, you know, I could make a Mickey Mouse mold and then spread. I'm going to Orlando today, which is why I'm thinking about it. Make a Mickey Mouse mold and spread it into a silicone, you know, thing, then I could make a whole bunch of turkey things that way. So I never thought that, like, weird shapes was an interesting application for me for a 3D printer. And lo and behold, we came up with this, what I thought was a good idea, in conjunction with Jeffrey Lipton, who runs the program, the Fab at Home program up at Cornell. And it was, we're going to take what I think is one of the ultimate pastes of all time, which is masa dough, nixtamalized corn. I mean, it's, you know, what's better than masa? Nastasha, anything?
You're going to Boca.
Oh, whatever. Florida. Anyway, so is there anything better than anything? No offense to Florida, but, you know, it's just not my place. So, you know, I hate the sun. I hate, you know, flat landscapes, and, you know, Spanish moss is okay. Anyway, whatever. Nothing better than masa, right? So we have this thing where we print out this squiggly shape of masa, and it looks great, and it has a great texture like shredded wheat, but it tastes awesome like a tortilla chip. I thought it was fantastic. CNN shows up. We give them this long song and dance about, you know, what these applications are good for, you know, what the printers are really good for, coming up with maybe with new textures, or for, you know, ideation, thinking about new ways to make things. And they basically, you know, and what I say, what I'm not interested in is this whole idea that in the future it's going to be the Jetsons or Star Trek, and you're going to push a button and all of a sudden your meal is going to come out. And, you know, for instance, there's nothing I think worse in the world than thinking that if you press a button, your meal is gonna pop out. I mean, what could be more horrific to a cook than thinking that we're totally going to remove human beings from the cooking process? And furthermore, you know, get us even further away from the food chain, from where our food comes from the whole food supply system, to a point where we don't care that everything that's served to us, you know, comes in a tube and is extruded out of a syringe into random shapes. Honey, what shape do you want your turkey paste in tonight? We had Mickey yesterday. Goofy? I mean, seriously, what is that, right?
Right.
That's crazy. Anyway, so I thought we had won over the CNN money people, and yesterday I looked at the CNN money piece on the web, and I was horrified to see that what they took away from it was that in the future we will basically print turkey paste.
But you knew that. We spoke about
this. I felt like we had made a connection with them, and that they kind of, you know, understood at least our point of view, that that was a horrible, horrible, horrible idea. Anyway, go read our post on it to see what we think about it. That's enough diatribe, right? Enough diatribe for today. All right. So we have a couple questions in from John Meyer. Met him, day before?
Yes.
And first question is on cheese tempering. So the question is, hey, listen, I bought some cheese and I put it in my fridge. Yeah, I think maybe that was, you know, maybe the first mistake, put it in the fridge. I mean, it depends. If you're going to buy the cheese today, I would never put it in the fridge. We'll get into that. I have cheese. It's in the fridge. I forgot to take it out. Or I bought it, you know, right before I went to somebody's house, and it was in the refrigerated case at the store. The store doesn't know how to keep their cheese, XYZ, whatever. And the problem is now I have to eat it. What can I do besides throwing it in the oven and or the microwave, or just waiting for a couple of hours? Well, I feel your pain, John. I really do. I remember once I flew back from France, and I smuggled in my favorite cheese in the world, which is Vacheron Mondor. My wife used to have to go out to France, to Paris, every January for a trade show, and I would go out with her, and I would, you know, just basically swim through like wheel after wheel of Vacheron Mondor, and you know, you cut off the top, you scoop it out, you eat it all. And there really is almost no better experience on earth than crusty bread and Vacheron Mondor. Just the, you know, that's it. That's kind of the apogee so far in my life. I mean, anyway, hopefully it gets better. Right? I mean, you hope that you don't have the, like, you know, the ultimate food experience like that, and you know, you're only not even 40 yet, and then that's it. Anyway, so I smuggled this thing back, and I'm planning on having Sunday family dinner, because every Sunday I have family dinner. The family comes over to my house, and we cook a big meal. And horror of horror, it was put in the fridge. I won't say by whom. It was put in the fridge, and there wasn't enough time to temper the thing out, and I was, you know, it was one of the worst food experiences of my life, because it tasted good. I put it in the oven, but it wasn't the greatest thing in the world. It wasn't what it should have been. Like, here you smuggle this wheel of cheese back, you think it should be the greatest thing in the world. It wasn't. So I definitely feel your pain, John. Here are my suggestions to you. One, if you're buying cheese, just don't put it in the dang fridge. If you have a wine cooler, put it in the wine cooler, let it sit there. Unless it's going to go for a very long time, it's going to be fine, or something like a mozzarella. Even when I buy mozzarella, I buy it, I don't put it in the fridge. Even if I buy it in the morning, I'm going to eat it in the evening, I don't put it in the fridge, because I know I'm going to put it in the fridge or freeze it after I'm done that first day, because I don't carry it over to the second day anyway, because I use it for cooking at that point. And mozzarella really will be okay in a cool spot for the whole day. You don't need to worry about it. That's one. I should also further say that there are some people, I'm not one of them, but there are some people that feel that cheeses should be served a lot cooler than we serve them in general, that they should be served at cellar temp, basically at your wine cooler temp. I don't agree with that, but there's some very, you know, fine cheese sources that do say that. Okay, so one is just don't ever put it in the fridge. This would be my first recommendation. Second would be, you could, and this doesn't apply to soft cheeses like Vacheron or things like that, but harder cheeses, and I hate this, but you could do this. You could cut the cheese up into slices beforehand, cover it with a layer of plastic wrap, and chamber them, because they'll chamber very rapidly if they're cut into pieces. I happen to not like that, because I hate the look of the cheese as it warms up, sweating out, or the fat coming up to the top. I don't prefer pre-sliced cheese, but this is definitely an option if there's no other alternative. Now, on the subway over here, I thought of a third alternative that you might want to look at that I've never actually tried, but I guarantee it will work. That is, take tap water, turn it on, so that the temperature of the tap water is roughly in the mid-80s, so slightly below your body temperature, but slightly warmer than your normal tap water, which is probably running between 50, depends on where you live, but could be as high as 60 or 70 degrees. Put it up to about 80 degrees, and then put your cheese in a Ziploc bag, and use the instructions on the Cooking Issue blog under the low temperature primer on, which I need to finish, jeez, how to package things in Ziplocs. Basically, you put it in a Ziploc and you immerse the thing in the Ziploc underwater to force out the air. You close it, then keep that Ziploc bag in the running tap water at the right temperature, and it will chamber lickety-split without the water getting on the cheese and without overheating it, because I really find there's no good way to temper out cheese in a microwave or in an oven without ruining a good portion of it. What do you think, Steph?
I think that's a good answer.
Yeah, good answer. All right, good. Thanks. Okay. Second question from John is, I saw Richard Blaze on his television program. I was trying to make pizza, threw a bunch of Binchotan charcoal in there, and got his oven up to, you know, 800, 900 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a good trick. I hadn't thought. Oh, the question is it going to ruin your oven? Is it safe, et cetera, et cetera? Well, that's a separate question. But I feel that would work. I mean, I have electric electric stone heaters in the bottom and top of my oven to jack the temperature up to 850. That's how I do it. But you could definitely light coals in your oven. Here are the caveats. One, the Japanese have been cooking with coal indoors for a long time. Every bag of coal that you purchase will say right on it that you're not allowed to cook it inside. And the reason is they don't want to generate A, a lot of smoke, and B, a lot of carbon monoxide. So, you know, one, I would say that if you're going to burn coal inside of your kitchen, you better have some good ventilation. That's one. Please have some good ventilation. But that said, places that do have good ventilation do it inside, although no one in the United States will tell you it's safe. Okay. Secondly, he's using Binchotan charcoal, which is an extremely expensive form of Japanese charcoal, which theoretically, they say, gives off less smoke than our standard ordinary charcoal here in the U.S. However, if you buy real hardwood charcoal that you open it up and the thing looks like it was a piece of wood back in the day and is now a piece of charcoal, I mean, I don't know how much better the Binchotan can be than that stuff. It burns fairly clean for a charcoal you can get here and isn't that expensive. They carry it at Home Depot. They carry it at some stores. So you could do that. Now, it's going to – Binchotan or whatever, you know, Kingsford briquettes. Don't use Kingsford briquettes in your oven. But any of these things – nothing against the Kingsford Corporation. But any of these things, no matter what, are going to generate some carbon monoxide. So you need to be aware of that, and you need to ventilate it properly. The third thing is, are you going to damage the oven? Well, it's possible. Depends on what your oven is made out of. I mean, I would elevate the stuff on a grate. You're going to need to make sure that you have a sufficient air supply in your oven to get it started. And I would also put a heat shield above it, like a piece of steel or something above the direct flame. So if you were to build put your pizza stone in the bottom of the oven, then build the Binchotan on top of that, then have some sort of like a deflector shield above in case you get a roaring fire up. Please try not to get a roaring fire. I think theoretically is possible. Also, don't overload it. Don't go crazy. You're basically just trying to get an extra 100 or 2 degrees out of it because your oven's probably going to make it up to 550 and you're only looking for an extra couple hundred degrees out of it. So I think the idea is just to not go super crazy with the amount of coal that you put in, right?
Yeah, but he lives in New York, so he's renting.
He does?
Yeah. It's not really his oven. He's renting.
Oh, well, if it's a rental, then go ahead. Do it. Then when your landlord comes, be like, huh? Yeah. What? Yeah. If you're in New York, I doubt you have decent ventilation. I'll tell you a little story. I might have told this on the radio once already. I did?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I once lit enough coal in my house. I have a good hood. I once lit enough coal in my house to ignite the small hibachi that I had put into it, and almost got me divorced. Anyway, so be careful. Be careful. Although I have seen people light Binchotan charcoal inside our amphitheater at the school and not have basically any smoke at all. Because, you know, they would light it on top of the gas burners. They would ignite it and then they'd pull it off. And it is fairly clean burning, more clean burning than most of our charcoals. But again, only use it for that extra couple 100 degrees to pump up. All right, so listen, we're going to have you call in all your questions too. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. We're going to go to our first commercial break, Cooking Issues.
How you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
Ain't so much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I feel all right.
I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, brother? Right. Hey, yeah. Sure getting down. We're gonna have a bunk good time. 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 Let's take them up, Fred. We gotta take you high. All right.
You wanna do it again? You wanna do it again, huh?
Welcome back to Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. Call in your questions too, 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. I hear we have a caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, I was listening to the first part of the show, and I also find that things are bad when they're put in the fridge. Why is that? What is the chemical reaction happening that takes taste away from, like, vegetables and cheeses and meats and, like, cured meats when they're actually put in a cold space?
That's a very interesting question. I think, you know, everything's different with different products. So, you know, in tomatoes, it's the texture that gets ruined of the tomato, never to come back. Cheese, a lot of it is reversible. We did a study once where we took balls of mozzarella, fresh ones, all from the same batch, and we refrigerated some and then let them chamber for a long time back. It's posted on the blog, but a long time ago. And we did, you know, most of it actually does come back. We think there is some effect that putting it in the fridge ever hurts its texture irrevocably, but it's not as much as we generally think, because the texture of cheeses is so dependent on temperature that even a couple of degrees in the center of, like, a ball of mozzarella or something like that means the difference between it being, you know, delicious and, you know, oozy, you know, awesome, and being rubbery, right? So it's like, part of it is the fact that I think we never do allow something enough time to chamber up. But I mean, also like something like cured meats also, I haven't run a side by side clearly out of the, like, you know, everyone says when you're tasting cured meats when they're cold, you know, put them on your tongue, let them warm up. But it's not, I mean, look, it's not the same thing as having a piece of meat served to you at the right temperature and not having to, like, lay it on your tongue for 30 seconds to try and warm it up. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So with that, I don't know what the actual problem is. I mean, certain effects like this, like with cheese, the question is, or tomatoes, this happens just from the temperature change. And then there's problems with the refrigerator itself. So, you know, like or freezer, right, which could be desiccating, it could be removing moisture, it could be adding really bad aromas. Most fridges, like, you know, most fridges have awful aromas on the inside of them. Just turn off the fridge, which allows the volatiles to become, you know, kind of, you know, better for your nose. And you can see kind of the nasty things that are going on in your fridge. But I'd have to research kind of other, like, which vegetables do you have in mind as being never as good when they're in the fridge? Some, by the way, are never as good after they're stored, period, because you change their metabolism. Most of these vegetables, a lot of vegetables are basically still alive when they're being pulled, right? And so, you know, you alter their metabolism rate, you change their metabolism rate, and they just are turning to crap anyway. So the fact that you're putting it in the fridge and storing it for longer means you're reducing its quality. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
All right. Well, I'll look into this more. Maybe we'll talk about it. Right, Nastasha?
Right.
We'll look into this more, and
Thank
we'll talk
you.
About it more. All right. Did I hear another ring? Do we have someone in or
no?
Okay. So I have another question then from John, and this is a doozy. This is going to take a while. So dig yourself in, Nastasha. Nastasha's going to actually have to pay attention instead of, I don't know, doing whatever she normally does.
What is that?
Drift off into sleep while I'm speaking. The question is, and this was actually posed to me by several people in the past couple of days. Why is it, or how is it, that we use salt to melt ice on the roads, right? Although we're usually using calcium chloride, not sodium chloride, but the principle's the same. Why do we do that? And at the same time, when we're in a kitchen, if we want to make something really, really cold, we want to keep our stuff cold, we dump salt onto ice. So in one case, it seems like we're using it to melt it, which seems like we're warming it up. And in the other case, we're using it to actually cool it down to make it, you know, colder. And so what's going on? Seems like a contradiction, right?
Right.
It's not. It's not a contradiction. And this is something that is actually poorly explained by most high school teachers when you're learning it. Not by my high school teacher, Mrs. Zook. My chemistry teacher was awesome, and maybe that's the reason why where I am today.
I never had snow in
where's
California,
that?
So I...
Oh, nanny poo-poo. All right. So, you know, I come from a place where we have seasons, where I don't have to drive to see snow. no offense, California. Okay, so here's what's going on. When you add, it's actually kind of complicated, but, you know, bear with me. It's all about a fight between heat, enthalpy, and entropy, right? So here's what happens. In order to melt ice, you need heat. That makes sense, right, Nastasha?
Yes.
You need heat to melt ice, right? And the reason why is because ice is at a lower energy than water at the same temperature. So in order to make it from ice into water, You have to add energy, and that's called the heat of fusion, right? And that takes about 80 calories per mole, right? So every gram per mole, per gram, whatever. Anyway, 80 cal. Melting 1 gram of water is enough. I'll put it this way: melting 1 gram of water, I believe, is enough energy to raise that same gram of water 80 degrees again. That's how much energy it is. So it's not insubstantial, right? It's a lot of energy. It's called the heat of fusion. Okay, so it requires energy to melt the ice. Now, which means, right, that things want to be at a lower energy. So, in general, things want to turn into ice to go into that lower energy state to give off that that heat and become ice. Now, there's a competing principle here, which is things like to be disordered. Entropy, right, is basically how much disorder there is in a system, and the universe wants to be disordered, chaotic, have lots of different states available for everything, maximum chaos, like our lives, and so what happens is that. At 0 degrees, where ice normally melts, it's the point at which the amount of entropy, right, the amount of heat that you have to add to melt the ice is balanced by the amount of entropy gain you get from melting it. This does not make any sense, people. Read it on our blog; it'll make more sense. But it's this fight between enthalpy and entropy, and it's all balanced on temperature. When you add salt to the system, right? What happens is that now it's more states of disorder that water can be in when it's in the solution with the salt. So therefore, right, the entropy win is greater, and the temperature at which the stuff freezes drops. So now you can forget everything I said for the last 3 minutes, because I'm sure it didn't make any sense. Read it on our blog and keep this in your head. When you add add salt to ice, what you're doing is making it so that everything wants to freeze at a lower temperature. And we all know that, salt water freezes at a lower temperature than ice, right? So here's what goes on. In order for the ice to melt into salt water, you need to have heat. Heat needs to go into the system to do it. But where's the heat going to come from, Nastasha? Where's the heat going to come from?
Salt.
No! The heat's going to come from the ice. The heat's going to come from the ice. So when you take a big block of ice and you add salt on it, right? Like, the ice is going to start to melt into the salt. It's going to form a brine. But in order to do it, it's going to require heat. That heat has to come from the block of ice, because that's the easiest way for it to get it. It's not going to suck it out of the air, because that's not fast enough. And so the entire block of ice, along with the salt brine, is going to get colder. And that's what's happening when you're making your mise en place, right? Now, if there's not enough ice there, right, to all get colder and not melt, you melt it all out, right? Furthermore, if you let it sit there for a long time, energy is going to go into the air, and then it's going to keep remelting more. So it's basically the same thing happens. When you put salt on ice on a road, initially the whole block of ice is going to get colder, right? And then it's eventually going to melt off, as long as you've depressed the freezing point low enough such that it can't freeze in your ambient atmosphere. And that temperature where it's going to freeze, right, in ambient atmosphere in a fully saturated salt solution is quite low, like in the minus tens. So the system all works, and it's not a contradiction, and that didn't make a damn bit of sense. No one's going to understand what the hell I was talking about.
You should have your old chemistry teacher on.
Mrs. Zook? Yeah. We should have Mrs. Zook on. But you can go on the blog and look up Cocktail Science. The very first Cocktail Science I posted about a year and a half ago has a much more lucid and easier to follow, easier to reread explanation of it. And I apologize for kind of going all over the place. What do you think? Did it make any damn sense at all?
We have a caller.
We have a caller, even though that made no damn sense at all. All right, caller, you're on the air. Hopefully I'll make more sense.
Oh, hi, sorry, this is Antoinette. I have a question that's completely off topic, so I don't know if you want to wait for me a few more minutes to go through the ice.
Well, no. Well, how off topic? Let's hear it. Like, really? Like, something about cars?
No, I was wondering, have you read Andrew Baer's Mark Twain's Feast?
No, I haven't. Tell me a little bit about it.
He goes through Twain's A Tramp Abroad, and Twain went through how he loved all these American foods that no longer exist. And he tries to recreate all these dishes from the 1800s.
Oh, how is it?
I recommend it. I do recommend it.
I love Twain. I mean, I love Twain. He's one of the great kind of, you know, funny misanthropic writers, you know, of America. Wouldn't you think?
No, definitely. I agree. That's why I think you'll like this book. I definitely recommend you get it. And what I was calling about is Twain apparently liked his coffee, American coffee, much more than coffee abroad because of our milk. And they're guessing it's because it was raw milk. And I wanted to know your thoughts on the raw milk debate.
Well, okay. I mean, so their theory was that the milk in Europe was pasteurized before the milk was here. I don't know. I don't know the actual, I don't know the truth or falsity of that. I know that the milk we used to get was alternately, the milk back in the day, like pre-Erie Canal, pre-railroad into New York City, the milk we used to get was alternately, was horrible here, but could be much better in the country, where now we kind of get a kind of broadband, mediocre milk, no offense to the milk people. My feeling on the raw milk is that I'm sure that there is both good milk, good raw milk, and bad raw milk. I've had some fantastic raw milk, and I'm sure you're aware that, you know, here in the United States, you have to buy it directly from the farm. So, for instance, we have a farm at the Green Market here in New York that sells raw milk when you buy it in upstate New York at the farm, and it has warning labels all over it, but they can't ship it into New York to sell it at the farmer's market here. Do you mean my debate on its taste or my debate on the law? The law is absurd, but I mean
the law. Okay,
the law is ridiculous. The law was originally put in place because they thought that you could get tuberculosis from cows, and so they started pasteurizing the milk. I'm sure pasteurization has done a lot of good, you know, in keeping milk for a longer period of time. But there's no question that. I mean, you can have really good cheeses that are made with pasteurized milk. Obviously, I've had many, but, you know, that said, you know, most of the great cheeses of the world outside of the U.S. are made with unpasteurized milk. So it would be interesting to do a side-by-side test, which I've never done, of the same exact company, same exact process, pasteurized versus not, same milk, same cow. I've never had that happen. I had great experience with the raw milk that I've purchased at farms here, but it's because they're great farmers and they make great milk. Do you know what I'm saying? And the milk and a lot more happens to our milk other than just pasteurization. You know, it's broken up, it's homogenized. So you know, I think there's a lot wrong with our milk supply based on what it could be. I mean, it's really only ideal in the sense of it's relatively cheap compared to what it actually, you know, probably should cost if it was done right, and it lasts a relatively long time. But that's about all I can say kind of good about it. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a little absurd, the law, again, like as you said before, but also I think it's almost impossible to really recreate the milk that Twain is talking about, as Andrew Behrs is trying to do in the book. I don't know how we would possibly be able to recreate it exactly.
Yeah, I mean, there are people that have the same kind of breeds of cows. They're treating them in the same kind of way. It's just not mass. I mean, I'm sure in a micro way you could go reproduce it because, you know, you could go to someone who's pasturing a very similar cow. The breeds of cow that were, you know, around back then are still extant. And, you know, you could get them. You could find someone milking them. And you could get it directly from the cow. You know, this is all possible. It's just not feasible in New York, for instance. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've talked to a bunch of food scientists who say that I'm a jerk for saying that the law is absurd because they point to the fact that, you know, indeed there are diseases you can get from raw milk cheeses that haven't been pasteurized. And it is true that there are a certain number of people who, you know, can, I guess, contract diseases from raw milk. However, I'm more than willing to take that risk. And 9 times out of 10 nowadays in the U.S., when someone gets a disease off of a cheese, for instance, or a dairy product, it's off of a pasteurized product that's just been stored incorrectly. So, I mean, the big you know, problems in the past, I think in the 70s and 80s, were like queso blanco, queso fresco, that were just, you know, not, that didn't have any because, you know, having a bacteriological, you know, having a bacteria component, a culture in the milk, protects it against certain pathogens. So I think it's actually kind of these pasteurized and then stored in properly recontaminated products can sometimes be less safe. But, you know, again, I've had dairy scientists, you know, just tell me that I was a complete jackass for saying that. But, I mean, I think we should just slap a label on it. I'm allowed to smoke if I want. You know what I mean? For instance, and I think that's a lot more dangerous than, you know, eating the cheese that I want. And I think, and their point is, yes, but the consumer doesn't know that there's a risk to eating cheese, whereas they know there's a risk to smoking. So I say, hey, why don't we just slap a warning label on it? And they're like, well, a producer wouldn't want to do that. And be like, I would love that. You kidding me? Like, you think that the people that I know, that I hang out with, that are paying $1 bazillion a pound for a block of cheese anyway, right? And I used to – cheese was always my favorite thing in the world because, it, you know, my theory was I could afford – the best cheese in the world. I can't afford the best wine. It's no longer really the case because cheeses have gotten so expensive. But, you know, we can afford to have at least a little bit of the best cheese in the world. And I think that we would flock to a cheese that had a big old warning label on it saying it was made with raw meat. We'd look for it. It wouldn't be that it would frighten us. We would actually seek it out, you know. But anyway, that's just my feeling on it. But I'm definitely going to check out that book as a fan of Twain and as a fan of 19th century American cooking. And, you know, an interesting, you know, the take on 19th century American cooking, I guess, that most sticks in my head was, what was her name? Oh, my God. Hess. The couple. What was their name? Oh, my God. My head's gone. She was a famous food historian, and he was a New York Times critic for a while, and they wrote a book called Taste of America. She just passed away recently. She's a real curmudgeon. Like, her main gripe was that American food used to be great before the invention of baking powder. You know, and that baking powder ruined everything. That was her basic tenet. And she was real kind of like I think a tough individual. But she was hanging out with the likes of William Boyce Weaver and, you know, writers like that, people who really have kept you know, William Boyce Weaver is big on Pennsylvania Dutch and food saving and heirloom vegetables. And these guys have really brought back a lot of the old recipes. And I think there's a lot of value there. So I'm definitely going to check out that book. And thanks for bringing it to our attention.
No problem.
All righty.
Let's go to another break.
Oh, a commercial break time? All right, we're going to a commercial break. Please call in all your questions to 718, whatever it is, 497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues.
You feel good? Thanks so much, Bone Brother. How you feel, man?
I feel all right.
I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Hey, yeah. Sure getting down. We're gonna have a funky good time. We're gonna have a funky good time. We're gonna have a funky good time. We're gonna have a funky good time.
Let's take them up, Fred.
We gotta take you high. All right.
You wanna do it again? You wanna do it again?
Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Still got a couple minutes left here in the studio, although I'm told we will have to get off the air at 7:45 fairly promptly. 7:45. Oh, my God. 12:45. Oh, my brain. My brain is fried. I'm talking about frying in a minute. Call your questions, too. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. And we have a question about a registry. Huh, Nastasha? What do we got?
It's the same fried chicken guy, so which one do you want to go?
That's very nice. I apologize, Clayton, for you being referred to as same fried chicken guy. So that's why we call her the hammer. No tact, just a hammer, big blunt instrument.
No
anyway,
tact.
give us the registration question, and then we'll deal with fried chicken later.
All right, one more question, if he has time. I'm getting married soon and would like to use my wedding registry to beef up my kitchen. What are a few items that any modern cook shouldn't be without?
Okay, I would recommend you get some rich friends. That's the first thing. And register for an immersion circulator. If you do not already own an immersion circulator, you should register for an immersion circulator. If you throw 3 parties this year, you will be happy that you have an immersion circulator. All right, let me think about this for a minute, because I'm just thinking about this, and then we're going to take a call, and we'll come back to it along with the fried chicken question. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Hannah. I'm just calling because I like to buy kind of chicken and fish, and I'm always looking for a new healthy sauce to cook with them.
Right.
Do you have any recommendations?
A new healthy what? Sauce?
Sauce to cook with chicken or fish.
Wow. I in general, so you want a thick sauce or a thin sauce? You want something to serve, or you want something separate? Like, what are you looking for?
Well, I'm just getting bored of my ones, so I'm really open. I tend to just do kind of a tomato base, like a passata, with just onions and some spices. So anything different, really.
All right. So here's what I would recommend. Anytime you're looking to change your sauce repertoire, what first of all, there's a very good, very, very good book on sauces. I highly recommend it by James Peterson called Sauces. It won like a Beard Award like maybe about 12 years ago. It's available kind of very cheaply, I think, on Amazon now or, you know, use. It's a fantastic book. And what I like about it is it teaches like basically fundamentals of sauce making and how to build on sauces starting with certain bases. So what I would do is I would come up with a couple of techniques that you like that you can then build a bunch of flavors off of. So for instance, whenever I have a vegetarian, now you're talking about chicken, so it's, you know, it's different, but you can use the sauce. Whenever I have vegetarians coming over, I do one of it, which is a lot actually. I have various variations of fundamental coconut milk sauce that we make. And if you have a good blender.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, we'll do, you know, so it's a variant on Indian, but you could switch it to Asian or Thai if you want. It's just, you know, pre-cook your onions, your shallots, or whatever you want, your garlic, then put in your spices, you know, hit them with the heat a little bit. Then I usually put in cashews, sometimes tomato paste if I want it red, sometimes not. Then your coconut milk, you know, you heat, blend, correct with lime and or soy and or whatever. But I have like maybe 15, 16 sauces that I can build out of the simple idea that I'm going to start with frying my ingredients, toasting the spices, throwing in probably a nut to beef it up, and then coconut milk and blend. Similarly, I have, you know, 13 or 14 different variants of, you know, frying up. I say I'll start with frying the onions and garlic, frying that, and then, you know, some form of cheese, you know, and herb and oil blended. Or so they all work that way. And, you know, these are all basically separate sauces that you can make in advance. I mean, then, of course, the obvious is, you know, the pan sauce, whatever based on what's in the pan, which is usually some form of deglazing. So it all depends on kind of like building up your repertoire. I would choose a taste flavor that you like. Like if you like an Indian profile, I would get like, you know, a couple of the base spices in your kitchen that you need to do it, coriander, cardamom, cumin, you know, things like this, and have them just ready. And then, you know, whenever you want to make a sauce, you know, it's wherever your heart takes you that night, and you blend it. But it's just having, you know, if tomatoes your only base to start with now, then, you know, there's only so far you can go with that. So then you just stock out your pantry and get a couple of different, get an emulsified sauce in there, like, so start building on like hollandaise / béarnaise base differences, and those are delicious. Everyone likes them, and they're really quite simple. You don't need to have clarified butter. You know, you can look up Harold McGee, I think, wrote about it. We might have it on the blog. Very very fast hollandaise or béarnaise or any one of those sauces. No sauces form a fantastic base for other things. It's just a question of changing the flavors. And so you can really kind of alleviate boredom by just picking one or two of these sauce families, right? And then working with it from there and really, really expand out. And that's how I think all good cooks expand their repertoires, by like taking some new basic nugget and then building on it again and again and again through repetition. Is that helpful at all or no?
That is. And would you say using frying the herbs before you then add in the sauce?
It depends. So, like the classic, a lot of the dry spices and things like ginger, things like nuts, I tend to fry before I add the liquids, because I've never done a side by side though. It's interesting, but theoretically, you know, that's how it's done in those cuisines, and so I tend to do it. And you know, they say that it releases the aromas. I don't know if that's actually true. Well, it probably, if there's a high heat involved, it actually does probably do some sort of toasting, frying, and changing the base notes that are involved, because I know that, for instance, toasted caraway tastes very different from untoasted caraway. Not better, not worse, different. And so it's just, it tends to be something that I do. I don't ever pre-cook green herbs. I always like the dried spices, not dried herbs, more dried spices that you tend to hit. You know, just make sure you don't scorch the garlic, et cetera, et cetera. But then throw it all in the blender, and it goes. I mean, the blender is like, you know, especially I have a VitaPrep at home that'll take a pound of bacon and emulsify it into a sauce, and no one will even know it's there other than the flavor. No one will know from a texture standpoint. So a good blender is a definite sauce maker's friend in the kitchen these days, because it definitely saves me a lot of heartache. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, so
that was helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for the call. All right. Now I'm going to.
No. Why don't you just finish the wedding one? You can't get to the chicken.
Watch me.
Four minutes? Jack, you really think so?
You're taking a portion of my 4 minutes to tell me that I can't answer this question in four minutes. This is the lady who berates me for my Martha Stewart position where I was supposed to do three cocktails and did three quarters of a cocktail. But here we go. All right. Listen, I'm going to think more about your registry problem.
Vita Prep.
Yeah, but you can't register. Where can you register for a Vita Prep? If you can find a place, here's what I would want. Get yourself a Vita Prep. Get yourself an immersion circulator. Buy your own vacuum machine, or get a cheap one, whatever. Obviously, if you don't already own a decent set of knives, have them buy you a good set of pots. For Christ's sakes, get a good set of pots. I mean, when I registered, I had like a mismatch of different pots, and now I have like kind of the standard pots. And even though I got them, 18 years ago, whatever it is, 15 years ago when I was registered, I'm still loving them today. They're fine. I have the standard kind of all clads, but definitely hit all those big ticket items.
Ditch the China and get all that other
stuff. Yeah, forget China. Who wants China? It's gonna break anyway. Get the Vita Prep, get the immersion circulator, get some decent pots, get some decent knives, right? And then if Nastasha thinks of anything while I'm talking, we'll go for that. Okay, now, on your fried chicken question, you make fried chicken only about once a month. That's a reasonable amount, although, you can make it more. Keeping the oil, how do you keep the oil after you're done? Because the oil can be expensive. Is it worthwhile to keep the oil? Okay, listen. The enemies to oil are basically oxidation and breakdown when you're cooking and when you're storing. What causes that breakdown to happen, first of all, fresh oil is kind of bad anyway. You should always fry a little bit with your oil. It really picks up quick, especially at home, because you're probably pretty brutal on the oil. But fresh oil actually isn't the best. Like, you want to use it a little bit because what happens is the oil breaks down somewhat. And when it breaks down, it has more polar components, so it actually can attack the food and fry it a lot faster. So a little bit of oil breakdown is actually helpful, but in general, don't worry about your oil being too fresh at home, because it ain't going to be fresh for long. Anyway, so the main things that are going to kill your oil is if you're overheating it. If you overheat your oil, which you tend to do on, not you, but one tends to do on a stove, the temperature cycles up and down, and way high, that's going to ruin oil very quickly, and if it gets really dark in color, it's not going to be worthwhile, and you probably won't keep it. The other thing is if you get a lot of particles floating in the bottom that burn, those will cause your oil to go down really fast. And the second is if you're frying a lot of high liquid stuff, stuff sprays out into it, or lots of salts, you're going to notice the oil is going to start foaming a lot more, and the oil is going to go south fast. So a lot of how long you can keep the oil is how you treated it when you were frying. We use an oil. If you can go to a commercial supplier and get a 5 gallon, whatever it is, 30 pound or 5 gallon pail of oil, the professional fry oil that we use is 8 times better than the fry oil you can get in a supermarket, because it has antioxidants in it, which means the oil is going to last a lot longer. Okay, that's one. Two, when you store it, you want to let it cool down, and then right away that night you want to filter it through first like a strainer, and then through something finer like some napkins or cloth to get all the particles out of it, because those are really going to make your oil turn to crap. Then when you store it, you want to store it outside of the light, because if it's stored in the light, you're going to get more oxidation. So you want to store it in a dark, cool place. You want it to be filtered, and you want it to stay in a cool area. You want to make sure you don't do too much temperature cycling on it. And here's the best way to find out if your oil is crappy, right? Take a little bit of your oil, heat it up in a pan, and fry a piece of white bread in it, and then eat the white bread. White bread is extremely neutral. It soaks up a lot of oil, and it's the best way, other than just dipping your finger in and tasting it, to figure out whether you're going to get any off notes in your fried products from the oil that you're using. And that's my standard technique in the kitchen to determine if an oil has gone too far to keep using, is I do a bread fry test. All right, now I have 30 seconds. On the way out, Jarrett called in or wrote in, and he said, "Hey, when I make my dashi, right, I eat a huge bowl of it, and I get all buzzed, and I have to sit down and watch comedy programs because I get a buzz. Is this from the glutamic acid?" I don't know whether this keys in with the kind of pot questions we had before, but I definitely, although you gave us our recipe, I want to know kind of what secret ingredient you're putting in to get buzzed. I've never noticed this. I've never heard, I couldn't find any reputable cases of monosodium glutamate intoxication, but the last time I got drunk without drinking was an ice cream party, random. I found an ice cream machine. I'll look more, Jared, by the way. I'm about to go on a tangent on the way out of here. I found an ice cream machine on the side of the street, a soft-serve ice cream machine. It was all broken and beat and battered, weighed 900 pounds. I wheeled it into my apartment, wired it into three separate circuits because it took three-phase power, and it was all demented. Finally got it to work. The refrigeration didn't work, so I had to throw dry ice into it. All these nightmare problems. I had a giant soft-serve party where I actually went up to the Bronx to Mr. Softy, which is our local ice cream, soft-serve ice cream here, and bought a bunch of gallons of Mr. Softy ice cream mix and threw the most disgusting party in the world. It was all it was champagne and all you could eat soft serve ice cream out of an ice cream tap, you know, because we had the big soft serve machine with all the toppings. And I didn't even have anything to drink that night, but I must have eaten, I don't know, like a half gallon of ice cream. And I felt completely looped, drunk, crazy. And so that's the only similar experience I've had to a non-alcohol based buzz on a food I've done. And it wasn't related to MSG. Or to dashi, but I definitely want your dashi recipe if you get buzzed off of it, Jared. So I'll look into it some more. And for this week, it's Cooking Issues. Come back next week, next Tuesday, 12 noon.